Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and welcome to What Women Must Know. This show is really helping you to make informed decisions so you can truly make the best choices in your life for yourself and your family. And it's also an opportunity to expand horizons. As you will find today, it's a really fascinating conversation that I will be having. I am here in Australia. I'm down under. I've been here for almost 6 weeks and have had amazing conversations with people, extraordinary people, which I will be sharing with you in the weeks ahead. And I just, I'm so thrilled that you're able to join me and this very special guest that I have, especially my guest today. Before we jump in there, I just want to welcome anyone who may be listening for the very first time. And please go to my website. You're invited to opt in there or my Facebook page, What Women Must Know. My website is drcherylselman.com. And all of these shows get sent to you, whether they're posted on Facebook or whether they're sent to your inbox. If you opt into my website, I have another show on this network every Saturday at 11 a.m. called The Love Code, and that has more of a spiritual focus and always lots of inspiring and uplifting information. So I hope you'll be joining me by either opting into my website, Dr. Cheryl Selman, or over at my Facebook page, What Women Must Know. So, having said all of that, I am really excited about a conversation I'm going to have today with truly a remarkable man. So we're talking about how history is written by the winners, and particularly focusing on a true story of Australian Aboriginal culture. And it's a culture that I personally have great respect for. It's a culture that I've been blessed to have been able to spend some time with elders in the past when I lived in Australia. And I am just so happy that I've been able to get Bruce Pascoe onto the show today. So Bruce is my guest, and he is a Bunurong man, is a member of the Wathaurong Aboriginal Cooperative, and please forgive me, Bruce, if I mispronounced those Aboriginal names. He is also an award-winning Australian writer, editor, and anthologist. His works have been published nationally and internationally and have won several national literary competitions. He has combined writing fiction and nonfiction with a career as a successful publisher and has been the director of the Australian Studies Project for the Commonwealth Schools Commission. He has also worked as a teacher, farmer, fisherman, barman, farm fence contractor, lecturer, Aboriginal language researcher, archaeological site worker, and editor. He has appeared in the SBS TV program First Australians, and his best-selling book, Exploring the History of Aboriginal Agriculture, which is called Dark Emu, Black Seeds, Agriculture or Accident, has attracted considerable attention for its discussion of land management practices in Australia prior to colonization. It's actually a seminal work that has gotten tremendous amount of attention, and Bruce has won awards for this book, Dark Emu, and we're going to be exploring what his book really is revealing, his mission, and how to set the story straight about the history of Aboriginal culture before the colonization happened, and so much more. So first of all, Bruce, thank you so much for your time. I know you're traveling, and we've been able to squeeze this interview into your very busy schedule, so I'm just so happy to have this time with you.
It's a privilege to be able to talk to your listeners.
You know, we have listeners all over the world, and that's why I really wanted to do this conversation, because history is written by the winners, and when it comes to so much of history, the winners write the history they want, but it's not the true history, and that can't be any truer when it comes to the history of Aboriginal culture, which has thrived in this country. I don't know how, you would know, what's the statistic now? How many thousands, tens of thousands, hundred thousands of years have Aboriginal people lived on this continent?
Well, a minimum of 120,000 years. whether recent archaeology has found that to be so. And it's just extraordinary that 230 years have gone by before Australians have taken any interest in the archaeology of Aboriginal Australia.
And that's where you come in. So before we jump into what you're really revealing to Australians about the true history of this land, I just want you to share a little bit about yourself and your journey. You have had quite a varied life, you know, as an academic, as well as, you know, involved in so many other professions. What is it that really now is driving you, Bruce?
Oh, well, you know, my Aboriginal heritage is the major driver because it's been a great distress to our people that this fabricated history is told about us. And we've been trying to have this discussion with Australia for a long time and haven't been getting anywhere. So now that we can actually have a better conversation with Australia, where we're trying to do that as diplomatically as we can, because there's some harsh truths to be told. We don't want to truncate the conversation. We need to have an in-depth and prolonged conversation about it, and sometimes you have to be a little bit gentle in the way you go about that.
And you have, out of your own personal history, it's that conflict of who you were told you were and then who you discovered yourself to be. Can you share a little bit about that?
Well, there wasn't much talk about the family background in my family, but one of my uncles had a lot of knowledge, and he was happy to share that with me and some other members of the family as well. But it wasn't until, you know, I started learning that when I was 9, got a lot more information when I was about 17, but it wasn't until my daughter was 5 years old and I was about 30 that I realised that in order to answer her questions about the family, I needed to know a lot more myself. And so I began a prolonged campaign to seek out the threads of the family story, and every week since has produced another revelation.
So what was that revelation for you?
Oh, well, it's when you go through the family history, you find that our people have been in contact with Aboriginal people throughout. Even in the period of denial, which began in Tasmania, which was one of the crudest frontiers in the world in terms of colonialism, where murder was a daily event, terrible atrocities were perpetrated on our people, and our people did remain on mainland Tasmania when a lot of our people were removed and onto the offshore islands. The only way to survive in those days was not to be Aboriginal, basically. And so some family members and other families in Tasmania took that route. But my mother's family was different because we have got a Yuin background as well as a Bunurong and a Tasmanian background. But my mother's family is equally fascinating and equally as disturbing. Because we were part of the Shaolin family and with links to the south coast of New South Wales, and that's where I live now. And all of these pieces of information I've been collecting for 40 years, and it reads like the history of Australia, really. What's happened to the family is like a mirror image of the history of Australia. And it's very upsetting. And even yesterday, I had a gentleman trying to sue me for maligning his family in one of the books that I'd written about the Frontier Wars, a book called Convincing Ground, and he wanted to sue me because he knew that his great-grandfather had never killed any Aboriginal man. And so in order to answer his demand for a retraction, I had to go back through my research notes and relive it all again and write down all the events where his great-grandfather had to have been implicated in murdering, not just murdering but maiming, by shooting people in the knees. That seemed to be his favourite method, so that gangrene would enter the system and kill people, and it would be called an accident. So I had to relive that yesterday. It was very upsetting for me, and all because Australia has no idea about its own history and is still in complete denial about it.
And that's what was, you know, so upsetting to me as I was reading your book, to understand the disparity of what Australians and the rest of the world have been told and what is the truth. So, I mean, that story you just told, I just want to reflect on that for a moment. So it's like this, the narrative is so strong that there is such, it sounds like from this gentleman, there's such denial that, you know, it's like living in an alternate reality and refusing to accept what their ancestors. Yeah. I mean, it's not even what he did. It's his ancestors, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and look, it's just a factor of colonialism. Wherever the British, French, Germans, Belgians, wherever they went, Spanish, they followed the same rules. And, you know, Christianity was in lockstep with the so-called explorers and discoverers. The Papal Bull of 1493, the Doctrine of Discovery, lays it out very clearly that Indigenous people around the world who were ignorant of Jesus Christ could safely be killed or removed from their lands and their lands stolen from them because of their failure to understand that whatever spirituality they had was inferior to the spirituality of Europe. And that was refined to an incredibly fine point in Australia. Every other continent had been invaded before Australia, and so all the rules were terribly well honed and very effectively used. And our people were not a warlike people, so it took us a decade or more to physically retaliate. Because of our law, Aboriginal law across the continent, is that visitors to country are to be treated hospitably. And so we just didn't understand what the British were on about. We just couldn't conceive that they wouldn't treat the land like we treated the land, and they wouldn't treat people like we treated people. So there was a mismatch of morality, and that mismatch is still happening today.
So for people who don't know much about or anything about Aboriginal, the history through colonization, what happened, why don't we start there? So what was the narrative, or what has been the narrative up until really you wrote your book, that has existed about, from that colonial point of view, Aboriginal culture was all about?
Well, the colonists, because of the Christian background, had to rationalise the commandments, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, and find some way that made the invasion not an invasion but a settlement. So they bent over backwards to describe Aboriginal people as subhuman, having no skills, having no houses, no clothes, no spirituality, no morality, no economy, nothing. Simple wanderers about the earth, hunters and gatherers or whatever. And so it was then beholden on Christians to take over the land and show them the light. But when you look at the real facts, what the first so-called land pioneers, the first explorers of country from Europe, what they saw was vastly different to what was written in the history books. Aboriginal people were seen harvesting crops that extended to the horizon. The yam fields for tuber production did the same. Watercraft were sophisticated enough to cross 30 kilometres of the ocean. You know, the reported history is so remarkably belligerent towards Aboriginal truth. And the only reason that Australia is in a better mood to look at this history is because with climate change, many of our farms are going to the wall. And so people know that they need to farm the land in a more considerate way, to treat the land more carefully. And of course, Aboriginal people, having been doing it for 120,000 years, had stored an enormous amount of knowledge and success. And so turning to our knowledge now is like clutching onto a life buoy in the sea, because it just so happens to have come at a very good time for Australia. It's sad that it's taken this self-interest for this to occur, but I do have a lot of faith in young people, and young Australians have a much more open mind to the nature of Aboriginal society than their parents and grandparents. So I do have hope for the future, but you know, I'm still hurting from yesterday when I had to try and answer the denials of one of the rich squatter grazing families from the Western District of Victoria. It's still biting me.
I can understand. You know, there for 240 years, that narrative, which has been the prevailing narrative, was that Aboriginal people were kind of, you know, unsophisticated in the colonialist point of view, right? I mean, they were hunter-gatherers. They were simple people, hunter-gatherers, and, you know, then they built their story, and that justified their decisions to take over the land, to massacre people, to kill people. I mean, I know the Tasmanian story is so sad because it was almost like a sport to go after Aboriginal people, which is unimaginable to think that intelligent, educated people would do that. But there's a defect in the thinking of these colonialists that they would, you know, be so inhuman to others. So now we're at a place where the truth is coming out, and this is where your book is so popular. You know, I started talking about you and your book to various people I've been meeting, and they're all telling me, oh, yes, I've read it. And then I tried to get a copy of the book. I went to about four different bookstores before I could actually find the copy. And they, one of them had just ordered a bunch of those books, and it just arrived because they were out as well, and they had a long list. So, you know, something extraordinary is happening here, Bruce. With your message and your, I mean, it's quite seminal in the history of Aboriginal culture in Australia and also, you know, white or what, however you define the dominant culture here is really open and amazed and shocked and horrified, I think, as I was reading your book, how we've been lied to about what really happened. I mean, I've lived in this country. I first arrived in this country 40 years ago, and I, you know, lived in Australia. I go back and forth now, but I have residency here and come every year. So I feel very connected and very, very privileged the times I have gone bush with elders and have great respect. So this, you know, it's so long overdue. It's been happening. I mean, slowly there's a time that the government acknowledged Sorry Day, and that seem to be moving in the direction where the government made an official apology, I believe. Wasn't it an official apology?
Yeah.
Of some sort?
Yeah. Yeah, I think we're moving towards something. I hope it's not superficial. I hope there's real change, fundamental psychological and mental change, rather than some feel-good effect of having
empty words.
Read a book and walked across a bridge and made a demonstration of understanding, but nothing changes. You know, legislation doesn't change, the Constitution doesn't change, the lives of Aboriginal people don't change. I fear that is a thing that happens reasonably frequently in Australia. So I'm working as hard as I can, and many, many, many Aboriginal people are doing the same, and many non-Aboriginal people too, to make sure that we embed this change in the national story and the national mind and the national educational system. I think that's the only way we can forge change, is if our eight-year-olds know the truth of their country.
Mm-hmm. So can we go back to what you were writing about? And I mean, you went to original sources and put this together. Is this the first time that there is a true story of the Aboriginal culture that existed here before the colonization? I mean, it's the first time that I've heard about it, but it may have existed before.
Look, a lot of really good, really smart people have been writing around this issue for decades. But when I started reading what they had written, adding two and two together, doing more research and starting to talk about it, I was met with enormous resistance from professors. You know, the best educated people in Australia were resisting this knowledge. And so I realized then that the only way you could argue this would be to use the sources that those conservative people respected. And those sources were those of European explorers, largely British, who were the first European entrants into country, and to read what they had read and to use their observations as something that academic Australia would have to accept. And so to that end, Dark Emu was a bit different to the other books in that it relied totally on white sources, absolutely, totally on white sources. And so it was very hard to argue against that, because people couldn't, as they had before in my other books, that accused me of trying to gild the lily of Aboriginal culture and history. And in this way, there was no way that they could use that excuse.
So can we talk a bit more about what that the original sources revealed about what was happening, how Aboriginal people have been caretakers of the land, what the land was like when they were caretaking it? Because Australia is known as this really arid land and desert and really hard to farm, and always there's always trauma and drama around the agricultural side of things. But what was happening under the custodianship of the Aboriginal people?
Well, the land was managed, but it was also manicured. The English described it as a gentleman's park. Not bush, not scrub, a gentleman's park, because Aboriginal people had been conducting an agriculture, had been horticulturally intense, and had been manicuring it. Aesthetically, so that every village was placed in an aesthetic grove, the paths were swept and raked, trees were pruned in order to make it attractive to the senses. So it was appealing to the British, who described it as a gentleman's path. But in the agricultural terms, you know, if I can just use a few examples, Lieutenant Grey in Western Australia came across yam fields that were so deeply tilled that he couldn't walk across them. And these fields stretched to the horizon in both directions. In South Australia, Charles Sturt, one of the kinder explorers, in that he hadn't killed anyone, nearly all the others had, Sturt, when he was dying in the desert, so-called desert, within this desert, Aboriginal people were harvesting grain and tubers, and they fed him roast duck and cake made from their grains. And for me, that was a seminal moment to read that where Europeans have been struggling for 240 years, Aboriginal people were living not just well, but luxuriously, by using the land properly, by growing the grains that want to grow here, rather than thirsty Northern Hemisphere grains, and working with the land. And in Victoria, the hillsides of the city of Melbourne were terraced in the production of yam. In Queensland, New South Wales, Thomas Mitchell rode through 9 miles of stooped grain. All of these words, stooped, tilled, terraced, harvested, they're all European agricultural terms, and they appear in the explorers' diaries, but they've never, until right now, appeared in the history of Australia. And so now that we are talking about people, Aboriginal people, terracing the land, tilling the soil, harvesting the land, building dams, irrigating crops, suddenly it takes on a completely different complexion. And I think it adds to the debate that, having refused to make a treaty with Aboriginal people, now the evidence shows that Australia is beholden as a Christian democratic country to forge that treaty.
You know, the belief is that this land is very poor, that it's such an ancient continent that the soils, you know, have eroded away, and it's really difficult to farm here. You need a lot of fertilizers. And but that actually is a lie. And maybe you can just elaborate a little bit more.
Sorry, I'm sorry to interrupt. It's not so much a lie as that it's the soil is very poor in Australia. You know, we're the oldest continent on Earth, the most eroded. Our fertility in the soil is low compared to many other countries. But what Aboriginal people knew is that there were some plants that wanted to grow in these conditions, that were drought resistant, could handle poor soils by developing massive root systems and reaching right down deep into the soil to pick up nutrition from a depth. So in some ways it's true that Australia is an infertile country, but plants have adapted to that country, and Aboriginal people have adapted to those plants. It's only the Europeans who have refused to look at the country as if it wasn't Kent in England.
And that was a huge problem, because when the English thought they can just transplant their English agriculture and husbandry onto this continent, disaster happened. Can you just help people understand what happened when they tried to do, when they did do that?
Yeah, well, I think we need to analyze the role of sheep in Australia. You know, for so many years we've said that Australia rode on the sheep's back because of the millions and millions that were made out of wool in this country. But sheep actually destroyed the soil. Australian soils were so light, and not having hard-hoofed animals on the continent, the
The soils were easily trampled by sheep, compacted, so that while the soil was losing its fertility and its tilth because of the compaction of sheep, there was also runoff happening. So for the first time on the continent, Aboriginal people were witnessing erosion caused by British-style farming activities. And so there was an enormous amount of change simply by the introduction of one animal, sheep. Cattle weren't much better. Goats were a terrible pest in Australia, still are. And the plants, the annual plants that the British were growing, like wheat, were depleting the nutrition of the soil, whereas our own grasses, even though their yield is much lower per acre than wheat and rice and things like that, they're much gentler on the soil and they add to the soil. They have a symbiotic relationship with the soil. And that's why Aboriginal people had favoured particular grains over others, because of that reaction, that soil-building quality of those plants, those ones with deep root systems who were contributing to the health of the soil. And having got rid of those, suddenly Australians noticed that the fertility of the soil was plummeting, erosion was increasing at an incredible rate, soils were blowing away. As a child, I remember the soils of the Wimmera region blowing in the air every summer. It was just an extraordinary time. And as a kid, I remember thinking, how can these farmers survive if their soil is blowing 300 kilometres out to sea? You know, what goes through the mind of someone who's supposed to be a farmer of the soil when he sees his soil blowing away? Does he ever question that his method may be wrong? And the vast majority of Australian farmers never did, never questioned that their methods were right, and yet they'd seen, in some cases, 18 metres of topsoil blow away.
Yeah. I also want you to mention, before I forget, to talk about the aquaculture, because that is something else that is so extraordinary that you revealed in your book, of how that became such a sophisticated and brilliant technology of managing fish and being able to have this abundance of fish for food.
Mm. Yeah, it's extraordinary to think that Aboriginal people had made fishing machines that automatically caught fish, but they also had weirs and dikes and channels where they could direct fish into holding ponds and harvest them at their leisure. And there were such an incredible variety of these systems which were adapted to the location where they were placed. And there was, you know, an abundance of food available to people. And, you know, it just seems incredible that we throw up our hands in Australia now every summer when, because we take out so much irrigation water from our major rivers, that they run dry in summer and all the fish die. And people go, oh, God, how could that happen? Never thinking that what fish need most of all is water. You know, Australia acts like a belligerent child when it comes to recognising the mismatch of their philosophy, farming philosophy, to the reality of the land. And, you know, I listened as a farmer in southern Victoria bemoaned the fact that his soil was blowing away because he was in a drought. Well, I lived in the same district. My farm was not in drought. It was dry, but it wasn't in drought because I wasn't ploughing the soil. If you plough light, dry soils, of course your soil's going to blow away. If you then put sheep onto that land, they will continue to worsen the situation for you. And it's no use standing on your veranda and feeling that God has let you down because your soil is blowing away. It's time to put your reading glasses on and go back to some books and do a bit of reading and start thinking about soil. you don't need to think about Aboriginal people necessarily, because a lot of Australian people don't want to do that. But just start thinking about soil. You're the farmer. Think about soil. Don't think about yourself. And don't blame bad luck. Blame bad farming for your fate.
Yeah, you know, it seems that farmers have such a resistant, conservative attitude. I don't know why. I don't know what it is, but there's such a resistance to look at other paradigms, to look at other practices. I think not just here in Australia, but around the world, people and farmers are being forced to reevaluate things because of the tremendous degradation that's happening to the land around the planet.
Yeah. Well, you know, while you were speaking, I was thinking of two great American books which talk about this problem, Grapes of Wrath and Silent Spring. Magnificent books, and they were very influential in my growing mind. But when I reread the new edition of Silent Spring and realised, you know, I knew when it had been published, but to be confronted with those numbers in the front of the book, 1970, whatever it was, it's just a shock. It's a real shock that what Rachel Carson was talking about, has no one has really addressed the problem. We're still poisoning the land. We're still ruining the land. Our soil that Steinbeck referred to is still blowing away. We're very slow learners when it comes to separating ourselves from a dollar. We don't seem to think about the future as a world. We don't seem to think about the future, and we have to.
You know, I live in Oklahoma, which was Dust Bowl territory. And Ken Burns did a really quite profound documentary about the Dust Bowl and went through the hardships and the cause of it, which was the monoculture. So, you know, that drought period ended. You know, all the suffering that happened to people, their illnesses, their displacement, and the realization that they destroyed the prairie and then went into monoculture, and that, you know, basically failed when the drought came. So you would think, Bruce, you would think that they have learned their lesson, right? But the end of that documentary, which was the most disheartening part about the whole thing, is that the farmers are right back doing monoculture, changing nothing, learning nothing, and here we are vulnerable again to this very same conditions that caused suffering in the 1930s.
Yeah, and being encouraged to do so by the chemical companies.
Yes.
You know, the chemical companies encourage farmers that they can produce fertility out of a bag. And, you know, people find eventually that even though they are growing crops, the biggest expense on their farm is to the chemist. And we've been finding in Australia, when we're talking about perennial plants, that the farmers who go over to perennial plants find that they cut their chemical bill into 10% of what they've been spending before. Suddenly, they're profitable. They may not be rich, but they're not going backwards. And a lot of Australian farms at the moment are going backwards because they pay more to the chemist than they do to the grocer.
So you are modeling on your farm in Victoria, right? You're in Victoria. Okay. So you're presenting a model of bringing back the plants, the farming methods. Can you share a little bit about what you are doing there, and as a model of what's possible for the future?
Yeah. Well, the farm that I bought was very run down, so I got rid of all the cattle straight away, and I gave it a year to rest. The regrowth was quite incredible, and we did have a reasonable season, but this has been a terrible season, and yet the farm is still looking good because the soil is able to retain moisture. We've done some works on the land which help us to retain that moisture. But we're growing the perennial crops. We're not growing anything that requires ploughing. So everything we do is perennial. And so we're going back to the old Aboriginal system. We're planting trees, and our crops are growing in between the trees, and some of them are growing under the trees. And we're just trying to get back that complex farming method that the old people used and that was so successful, because it wasn't a monoculture. Even in the areas where Europeans assumed that Aboriginal people were growing only the one grass or only the one tuber, there were always three or four. There was never just one. And the grasses we've found, all different heights, mature at different times of the year. So we can harvest a different grain every month of the year, right through the year, because of the smartness of those old people in designing their farming method around the available plants and the available seasons. So we've only just really started this over the last 6 years. I've only been on the farm for one, but already we're noticing a change. And we're employing Aboriginal people. I must say, on the proceeds of the book Dark Emu, which is selling very well in Australia and around the world, but we've been able to use that fortune to employ Aboriginal people to learn about their own traditional growing methods.
So I've noticed over the years there's been more and more interest amongst the culinary experts here to bring more Indigenous foods onto the plate in restaurants and on television shows. Do you find that kind of interest as you're bringing these old, ancient grasses back and tubers, yams? Do you think that's going to be an avenue for you?
Yes, I do. And, you know, there's been a bush tucker industry in Australia for, 10 years, but I refuse to use the term bush tucker because it talks about condiments and it fits into the myth of the hunter-gatherer that Europeans are so devoted to. But the grains and the tubers are staples. They're like the potatoes, the apples and potatoes, the oranges and pears, they're the staple foods of the country. And what I like about that is because you're talking about a culinary, you're talking about a farming method, but you're also talking about history. Because they were perennial plants and they were staple foods, it talks about Aboriginal ownership of the soil, Aboriginal devotion to the soil and ownership of the land. So that's a political point. But nutritionally, these foods are known to be incredibly good for digestion. Aboriginal people chose them deliberately for those things, for nutrition and digestive traits, soil building qualities. And they had 120,000 years to get all this right, to look at the land, study the land, trial various cropping methods. And, over that time, you're bound to get it right. As long as you're not distracted by get-rich schemes and, growing crops that actually reduce the quality of the soil but give you an incredible dollar. Aboriginal people weren't interested in a dollar. They were interested mostly in looking after the earth.
Well, it's really an inspiring story because I do believe there's a change happening and that there is a recognition that the way we've been going isn't working at all, and we need to go back to the wisdom that existed before. Mm. I know that you are presently involved with doing a film, I guess a television. Are they doing a television series with you right now? Is that the plan?
Yeah.
Is it a documentary, Ines?
Yeah, documentary.
So that must be really uplifting for you to know that.
It is. I've been looking forward to it. Yeah, but I'm really looking forward to it. I'm hoping that it'll get a new audience, you know, people who aren't necessarily book readers will start thinking about these things as well. So I am really looking forward to it because it's a beautiful story to tell.
Absolutely. Is this, by the way, is this an ABC production?
Yes, it is. We're not talking too much about it because, you know, there's still some way to go. But your guess is a sound one.
Okay, I don't want to preempt things. Well, I look forward to that because what your research, and again, going back to these original sources and to your culture, to your people, that this was a way of living with abundance, with caring for the land, honoring the land, working in harmony with each other for, you know, literally 120,000 years all throughout the continent, through all the different peoples and tribes. There were so many different Aboriginal cultures throughout this continent, but they all were in touch and they all were sharing their knowledge. So everyone lived an abundant, healthy life is what you're sharing from your research.
Well, the Aboriginal people were in touch, as you say, along the culture lines that crisscrossed the country, which brought information from one end of the continent to the other and across the continent both ways. So people were aware of the methods that other people were using, the climates that they were having to live in. So there was a lot of shared knowledge and a lot of shared story and a lot of shared government. The government of Australia in that time must have been so sophisticated, so muscular, so flexible to accommodate all those differences, all the language difference, the culture difference, geographic difference, and yet there was a harmony amongst all the groups that... you know, I can't think of an example in the world like it where a group of people would develop a social system that didn't depend on war for its survival. You know, there were Aboriginal people were human, so there were always fights because, you know, people are terrific at fighting each other. But the law prevented people going to war for land. It's a really crucial point. I say it all the time, but people seem to brush it away as if, you know, that's of no consequence. They're more interested in the bush tomato, the murnong, the grass. But the most crucial thing about it is a cultural development, a social development that predicated its whole system on an absence of war, a refusal to go to war for land, that it was amoral. I think it's an incredible thing, and I wish people wouldn't just sort of look over my head when I talk about it.
Well, that is really one of the most important points that you're bringing out, that this is a whole way to live in harmony with each other as well as with the land, which is what we are really looking for right now, which is something we desperately need in order to survive and thrive in the days ahead, in the decades ahead. We need to go back to that way of connecting. And I think, you know, from the experiences I've had, the more people connect back to nature, and I know that there is a growing movement of regenerative agriculture, which probably kind of, you know, is aligned with what you are doing and teaching. The more we connect back to nature and see that amazing transformation that happens when we allow nature to be supported and not devastated, that we change as well. There's a consciousness within us that changes because we are connected to nature. And the more we can be a part of it, there's a shift that happens within us.
I think it's very profound. I think it makes a profound difference to our psyche when we love the land. Instead of
And abusing it and, you know, raping and pillaging. you know?
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting. One of the things that I have become aware of in the last, I don't know, maybe 6-7 months, is the importance of getting up and watching the sunrise. And it may sound obvious to you, but it wasn't obvious to me. And the science is coming out that validates that when we get up and watch the sunrise from outdoors, not from inside, we actually set in motion all the circadian rhythms that are responsible for our body's ability to function optimally. And when we are denied sunlight, that we are, you know, totally out of balance, and all these systems start to fall apart. And it's part of that understanding that we are connected to nature, and we need to go back and honor her and connect with her.
Exactly. And next time you do that, watch the sun come up, think of me, because I'm doing the same thing. I have a ceremony that has been taught to me by the old people that I conduct every morning at sunrise to honour the arrival of Grandfather Sun. And I've been doing it now for over a decade, and it's the foundation of my life.
Well, you know, that's so beautiful. Thank you for sharing that, because it's becoming a foundation for my life, and I will definitely be thinking of you every morning as I am greeting the sun as well. You know, in the few minutes we have left, what is your vision for the future? What's your big picture that you are dedicating your life to right now?
Well, I want to see young Aboriginal people going back on.
I think, Bruce, are you there? Oh, darn. I think we lost Bruce. So I guess I'm going to have to bring our conversation to an end. I don't know about you, but I have so enjoyed having this opportunity to talk to Bruce Pascoe. Are you there, Bruce? I don't know. Anyway, I don't think so. He's such a hero in my book, and such a spiritual mission he's on. And I just was thrilled to be able to have him as my guest on the show today. So for all of you listening, I would definitely pick up a copy of Dark Emu. Check out the work of Bruce Pascoe, P-A-S-C-O-E. I know there are YouTubes of his lectures. I think you will be profoundly inspired, as I have been. And, it's reminding us all of the need to really connect back to nature, to honor the indigenous peoples who lived throughout the world. I know that I have spent time with Native American elders, with Hawaiian elders. I have been to the Amazon, met the Shipibo. I've been to Machu Picchu, where I've met the elders who lived up in the Andes. Wherever you go, the story is the same of how indigenous wisdom and culture and honoring the land was taken away by the cruelty of the colonists, and it's time we bring it back, because the future of our planet really depends on honoring their wisdom again. So if you, my listeners, have an opportunity to connect and learn from the Aboriginal, Indigenous people, be open to it. They have tremendous amount of wisdom and love to share with all of us. So having said all of that, I will bid you all adieu. Have a great week. My guest today has been Bruce Pascoe, author of Dark Emu. And until next time, I hope you will be joining me again for another opportunity to become empowered, expanded, connected in new ways to yourself, to this land. And as always, honor the wisdom of your feminine self. Bye for now.